Hello and welcome to At the Movies with Mike and Marie. I'm Marie Westhaver.
And I'm Mike Giuliano.
And we are going to talk about Danish director Lars von Trier today, starting with a quick discussion of what the Dogma movement was. And it had 10 rules to it, which I will read to you so you know what they are. Number one, shooting must be done on location. Props and sets must not be brought in. If a particular prop is necessary for the story, a location must be chosen where this prop is to be found. Two, the sound must never be produced apart from the images or vice versa. Music must not be used unless it occurs where the scene is being shot. Three, the camera must be handheld. Any movement or immobility attainable in the hand is permitted. Four, the film must be in color. Special lighting is not acceptable. If there is too little light for exposure, the scene must be cut or a single lamp be attached to the camera. Five, optical work and filters are forbidden. Six, the film must not contain superficial action. Seven, temporal and geographical alienation are forbidden. That is to say, the film takes place here and now. Eight, genre movies are not acceptable. Nine, the film format must be Academy 35 millimeter. And 10, the director must not be credited. Now, I'll say right away that number 10 was immediately abandoned as soon as possible. But all of these were part of a vow of chastity, which was meant to sort of strip all the artifice away from film and try to get to something that was supposed to be a new way of approaching filmmaking. What do you think, Mike, about the Dogma movement?
That's a terrific summary of what Dogma was calling for. I'll add, though, that Europeans love to issue manifestos. Directors. Now, American directors don't tend to do that. We don't think of the typical Hollywood director saying, "Here's my manifesto on what film should be." But when you look at the great Italian and French and other European filmmakers, they oftentimes would have formal manifestos. The thing that's notable about Dogma 95 is that it really was codified in the way you very astutely summarized it, but it was honored in the breach as much as the observance. What I'm getting at is when they put out this statement for Dogma 95, it got a lot of attention. That was the whole purpose. It's promotional, right? It gets them known. It's why we're talking about it right now in 2020, that this is what they were calling for. And it was a kind of calling card that way. When they set out to make their own movies, there are some that more or less adhere to every one of the 10 points you make. Thomas Vinterberg's Celebration, films like that are really very close in spirit to it. But when you look at the work of Lars von Trier, who's Danish, and many of his colleagues in Scandinavia, some of them follow it point to point, some of them, here and there. It's not rigorous, let's put it that way. And so as an overall statement of purpose, I think it holds for their work. But when you actually start watching the films themselves, again, honored in the breach as much as the observance.
I think it does a good job of concentrating on the story and the actors' performances as opposed to all of the cool things that you can do with cameras and lighting and filters and that kind of thing. So I think the idea behind it was sound. I think they boxed themselves in too much, which is why it's hard to find a purely film that, follows the vow of chastity to the nth degree. But let's talk about a couple of the Dogma movies that Lars von Trier made. The one that I like is The Boss of It All, which came out in 2006. And it's a weird movie to watch in some ways because it's shot with a camera technique called AutomaVision, where the camera angles and movements are selected by a computer. If you want bad framing, this is the way to go. It does feel unartificial because it feels like something deliberate because it's so odd. And some of the shots are so weird. But that in and of itself, you've just abandoned the whole idea of artifice. I mean, how much more can you be in control of the situation when you're letting a computer make the decisions? You're not even really directing at that point. The movie is very interesting because Lars von Trier does not seem to have much faith in humanity in most of his movies, but it's an interesting movie about responsibility and what it means to be truly ethical, because the boss of it all and the boss of the boss of it all lives in America. And this company is trying to finalize a merger, and they really want to talk to the guy in charge. So they go through a lot of machinations to try to hide the fact that they don't want them to meet him.
I very much like one thing you said there in terms of Dogma 95, that whatever you think of it and how effective it is or isn't, the greatest attribute is the emphasis on naturalistic acting. In other words, keep things simple, keep them focused on the actor. And even in some Lars von Trier films I don't particularly like, he gets some strong performances, doesn't he? I mean, really distinctive. And the actors like working with them because, you know, they're allowed to act. They're allowed to, you know, be on camera and do what they do. But, you know, again, with von Trier, how often he violates the very tenets of Dogma 95. I'll give a very quick example from an earlier film of his. I teach a course on Scandinavian film history. And there I use one of the few films by von Trier that I really like, because I have very mixed feelings about him as a director. I like a few of his films and I absolutely hate some of the others. But the film I use in my Scandinavian film history course is Europa, also called Zentropa, from 1991. It is set in Germany in 1945, just after the war's ended and that really messy period, the early months of the American occupation. It very much is a story of intrigue, of espionage. Not all the Nazis, you know, surrendered and went down quietly. A lot of them went underground as guerrillas, right? So you have this conflict here between the occupying American forces and what amount to guerrilla warriors that are still, you know, Nazis fighting the fight, and all the intrigue of, well, who's who and what's what. Now, watching the film, I admire it because it has so much technical virtuosity. It's beautifully shot, incredible camera work and editing, incredible artifice, if you will. A lot of the stage sets really are like stage sets, you know, set down in this rubble of post-war Germany. Almost everything I admire about Europa, I would say, is at odds with the Dogma 95 tenets, the 10 points that you made. Almost all of it goes against that. And so here, relatively early in his career, von Trier himself is violating almost every one of those 10 commandments, if you will, that vow of chastity. And yet the film Europa is literally hypnotic. It's mesmerizing because of the technical virtuosity, because of the really smart scripting and how it pulls you into the intrigue, the espionage, and all that. And so much of that is accomplished by the narration by Max von Sydow. I mean, he really quite literally is like a hypnotist pulling you into this story in post-war Germany. And so I love the film, ironically, because it departs from Dogma 95 in a lot of ways.
I don't know that he's the kind of guy who likes to be told what to do anyway. I think he is a agent provocateur. Almost all of his films have something challenging in them, but some of them do really well at putting across his ideas. And I'm thinking of Breaking the Waves in particular. Now, Nicole Kidman, who was in Dogville, which we'll talk about in a minute, said after seeing Breaking the Waves, she went home, got into bed, curled up in a ball and cried. And then wrote about her distress later, and it provoked her to work with Lars von Trier on Dogville. And the movie itself, I think, really is very powerful. It's an unusual kind of a story about a very religious Scottish woman who's played by Emily Watson, who finds a partner in an oil rig worker from Norway, but then he breaks his neck in a work accident and becomes paralyzed. So she kind of goes out to have sex with other men, which she comes to believe is God's work. And it's a very unusual movie. I've never seen any other movie like it. And it is absolutely compelling.
I agree with you completely. It's one of the films by von Trier that I like a lot. I mean, most of his films I don't care for. A few of them I vividly hate, you know, I mean, like in a visceral way, don't like. But I really love Europa. I also really like Breaking the Waves because it is a challenging, provocative film, and it keeps you watching. It's just so distinctive, isn't it? It's so unlike almost any other film for a few reasons. One of them is, again, even though I don't think von Trier himself abides by all the tenets of Dogma 95, the naturalistic acting that we've mentioned a few times. Watch Emily Watson's performance in Breaking the Waves. What a terrific showcase for an actor and for the character she plays. You know, and then you really are pulled into this story where, you know, she's married to this oil rig worker, that kind of troubled relationship. And it's a very Scandinavian film in a lot of ways, even though I know it's set in Scotland in the 1970s. The Scandinavian sense of moral challenge, you know, there's a strong Calvinist influence here. And certainly you can find it in British cinema to some extent, but I would say in Scandinavian culture in particular, this really, really challenging environment where the physical environment's challenging, right, where they live and so on, but also the religious environment and the really strict, really stern sense of religion and how all that percolates through the character played by Emily Watson. What do you think?
Yeah, and I think it's one of the things I think makes it so powerful is her performance, because it sounds like such a strange approach that she would decide that, well, you know, my husband is now paralyzed, so I'll go have sex with other men and come home and tell him about it, and this will somehow be a good thing. But somehow it seems utterly logical based on the character. And that's, I think, one of the reasons it's so memorable, is you haven't seen anything like this. Of course, I would probably say that about all of his films, but you've never seen anything like this.
But this one in particular, it's so distinctive. You've never seen a film quite like it. You also touch on one of the most problematic aspects of von Trier's career, namely that he loves to provoke, and he's full of ideas. Now, is he consistent? And this is where I start to turn against him oftentimes, not with Breaking the Waves, but with many of his films. Oftentimes, I feel like he's provoking just for the sake of provoking. He wants to get a rise out of the audience. He wants to get people angry. And oftentimes he has attitudes, positions, political or otherwise, that are really, really, you know, eyebrow raising. And you got to wonder, well, is this something he really believes? Or is he like that guy at a party who says something outrageous just because he knows it'll make you drop your drink, right? You know what I'm getting? And I think von Trier has that quality. He likes to get people aggravated. He likes to stir up things. And how much of it he actually believes, how much of it is intellectually consistent, is very debatable sometimes. I think sometimes he says and does these things in the films and in his own life just to get a reaction.
I think you've summed him up perfectly, Mike. But I do think another high watermark in his career was Dancer in the Dark with Bjork. What did you think of that one?
Well, you know, one thing is, again, as much as I have mixed feelings about von Trier as a filmmaker, because he works so well with actors, actors like to work with him. Think about the casting in Dancer in the Dark, which won the Palme d'Or at the Cannes Film Festival. So, you know, very highly regarded. You got Bjork in it. So there's still very much a Scandinavian thing, right? You know, with her appearing. And she's great. Talk about somebody who's distinctive.
Yeah.
Right? I've never seen anyone quite like her. But also look at the other casting there, the actors he attracts. And you'll be talking about Dogville presently, but think about, you know, Catherine Deneuve is in this, Joel Grey. I mean, it's like this oddball collection of like really talented people, but you don't expect to see them one next to the other. You know what I'm getting at? It's like, how did they all get involved in this here? And so the storyline there is that Bjork plays a Czech single mother who's working in Eisenhower era America, in a factory specifically. And so much of it would seem to be naturalistic there in terms of, you know, her character, the setting and so on, the factory environment. And yet the film is punctuated by musical numbers, which actually oftentimes work quite well. But talk about something that's at odds with Dogma 95. Dogma 95, you know, does not exactly call for MGM musical type numbers, does it? And so what do you make of that in Dancer in the Dark?
I think it was a way to showcase Bjork. I think he wanted to use the Icelandic singer. And I think it just happened organically like that.
Yeah, but isn't it very much at odds with the Ten Commandments that you read earlier?
Oh, absolutely. Yes, it departs big time from dogma, from the rules of chastity.
Why don't you talk about Dogville?
Okay, Dogville it is. Dogville, it sounds like a takeoff on Dogma. The thing that impressed me the most about Dogville as a film were the cast of characters, so many famous stars, Lauren Bacall and Nicole Kidman, all kinds of people in this movie. But the setting could not be more minimalist. It's almost like watching our town turned into sort of a horror movie. It's just the set is sort of drawn on the ground with chalk, you know, with people's houses sort of outlined in the chalk. But, you know, you can see everything going on, obviously, because there's no real walls up, which is one of the ideas in the movie, is that everybody knows everything about everybody else. There's an assault that happens in one quote-unquote house, and the camera shoots it through all the others. Nobody can hide from it, even if they don't look. It's a very simple way of showing the audience that everybody knows but is socially polite. It has lots of interesting ideas about it, how you can't really know your true nature unless given a real ungoverned power over another living being. How do you like that, Mike?
I like that description. Now, Dogville is actually set in the 1930s, Depression era setting, very much, you know, about America in that period. Ironically, and this is something that aggravated a lot of viewers, Lars von Trier himself has never been to America, and yet he's full of ideas about America, most of them critical, right? So he's gotten a lot of flack from American critics over that. But there's a pragmatic reason for his never having been to this country. It's his fear of flying. So yes, he hasn't been to America, but he knows all about it, or so he assumes. But he's just full of, you know, sharp critiques of American culture, which can kind of wear on you. Speaking of wearing on you, the film is 3 hours long. So, you know, even if you're with it, that's a long time to be with it, isn't it? And so the best description I've ever seen of Dogville was where one of the critics described it as a Brechtian deconstruction of Thornton Wilder's Our Town. Because it really takes that sort of, you know, really quintessential small town American image that we have through Our Town. And it really treats it in a very deliberately analytical and critical way, a kind of abstracted way. To your earlier point, there's almost nothing by way of, you know, scenery, props, you know, locations. It's essentially a soundstage, right? With chalk marks on the floor. And you know what it reminds me of? And this is one reason why actors love working with him. And that cast that you alluded to, it's Nicole Kidman, James Caan, Stellan Skarsgård, Lauren Bacall, Ben Gazzara, Chloe Sevigny. I mean, what do they talk about during the lunch break, you know? It's really funny that way. But the fact that, you know, think about actors working on a project. And think about theater. You do what's called a table read, where you sit down and just simply read the script together, right? It's just, it's totally early in the process. You're just reading the script across the table. What's one of your next steps? Well, you then take it to the stage, either script in hand or starting to memorize it. And none of the sets have been constructed yet. No props, no nothing, right? It's just chalk marks, or what actors call like their marks on the floor, like pieces of tape. You stand here, the wall's there. That's how he shoots this feature film, as if it were, you know, these actors slash characters on a bare stage or nearly bare stage. And so I love the idea of that. Honestly, after a while, it started to wear on me. And I just thought, you know, it didn't sustain itself for 3 hours. And that's where that more pretentious, really unbearable side of von Trier comes through. It's like, okay, some of his criticisms of America are valid, but goodness sakes, you know, let up already, or let us go already. I mean, you know, some of his films actually are, I would say, painful to watch.
That is a very true thing. And I should mention that the premise behind the movie is that this mysterious woman shows up in Dogville. She is being pursued by criminals, and the town offers to harbor her as long as she could make it worth their effort. So things start off all right, and then, of course, tensions flare, and things sort of spiral into the very dark place that Lars von Trier seems to want to inhabit. I want to mention that Paul Bettany didn't want to play in this movie because they were shooting in Sweden, but then Stellan Skarsgård told him that Lars von Trier's shoots were so funny that you'll miss something extraordinary if you turn the part down. So after shooting half the movie, he asked Skarsgård when the fun would start, to which Skarsgård replied, "I lied. I did it because he's amazing to work with, and you wouldn't be able to see that before you were actually here yourself. I wanted to give you a chance, and you wouldn't have shown up if I had been frank with you." So I think, yes, I think lots of people wanted to work with Lars von Trier, but I think it was challenging. Nicole Kidman said after Dogville she would never work with him again. Of course, she did agree to do some part in his movie Nymphomaniac, but then for other reasons she had to drop out. So very polarizing person. And part of that is, you know, we've talked about the good. I think we should at least touch on the bad, Mike. And I want to mention that I just finished watching to prepare for this. You know, I tried to look for the stuff I hadn't seen that he had done. And I watched The House That Jack Built with Matt Dillon as a serial killer who approaches all of his killings as a form of art, like performance art almost. And it was one of the darkest, weirdest, most troubling things I've ever seen. Some of the images will stay with me forever. And yet, there were these couple moments of absolute brilliance in terms of framing, shooting, dark humor. I don't think it saved the movie, but there are definitely moments where you're watching thinking, wow, this is just, he is one sick puppy. And yet, you see a scene, you think, this is why he's so popular.
Well, you know, this is one of his most recent films. The House That Jack Built came out in 2018. And you're right, it's Matt Dillon as a serial killer. Uma Thurman also stars in it. And it's so relentless, it's so extreme that honestly, I saw it and once was enough. You know, I'm not sure I want to see the thing again. And it had some really viciously negative reviews, which I thought were deserved. My favorite one was the New York Times critic, who really piled on. And when people don't like von Trier, they pile on, right? He described it as, quote, tedious, ponderous, obvious, and humorless. You know, he probably could have gone on at even greater length. Let me turn on that in the sense of, with von Trier, even though I have mixed and negative feelings about his films, most of them at least, even in the really bad films, there'll be something, a scene, a performance, something that's so striking that, yeah, it stays with you. Maybe not for the best of reasons, but it stays with you. In terms of like the good and the bad of him as a filmmaker and honestly as a person, let me give one anecdote here. He has a knack for getting himself in trouble. He says provocative things and, you know, everyone piles on there. How can you say that? And I don't just mean like in his movies. I mean in press conferences and interviews and that. The most notorious was at the Cannes Film Festival in 2011. And I've seen this footage at the press conference. He was there with his film Melancholia. At the press conference, he flat out says that he's a Nazi and he feels sympathetic towards Hitler. Well, not surprisingly, when he said that, it didn't go over so well at the press conference. And it was so extreme a response that he was actually, literally, banned from the Cannes Film Festival for a while. A few years later, they invited him back because, hey, movies are movies, right? And he was allowed back, but they wouldn't allow him there for a few years. His response to it was, when they asked him, how could you say that about being sympathetic to Hitler? I mean, it's like one of the worst things you could ever say, right? He said, well, I was joking. And people say, yeah, but we watched the press conference. There's no indication that you're joking there. And then he kept flipping. Sometimes it was just, well, I was joking. Other times, you know, that, well, I'm apologetic. And you know, I didn't really mean it. It just kept bouncing around like, well, what are you doing? You know, like why would you say that? And then like, you know, by way of damage control, he only made it worse. You know what I'm getting at? Like, he needs a good PR handler. Like, you got to clean this up. So that's the bad of it. I mean, how stupid, just how irritating that he would do things like that. Yeah, it gets a lot of attention, but negative attention. That's the bad of it. The good of it is the film he had that year, Melancholia, I actually think is one of his more interesting films. Stars Kirsten Dunst and Alexander Skarsgård, Charlotte Gainsbourg, Charlotte Rampling, all the Charlottes are in it. And in that film, it has a wonderful sci-fi premise. There's this rogue planet that somehow is hurtling towards Earth. It's one of those end of the world scenarios. Like if you were looking at the heavens and you really see this planet coming your way, how do you act? Do you get down and pray? Do you just go ahead and say, well, let's have a party, like the last party ever? What do you do? And I think the film philosophically actually is quite interesting. Also technically, it's well shot. It's just a really, you know, well-produced film. And I thought, well, here's this guy who makes these really stupid remarks about Hitler at a Cannes Film Festival press conference and deliberately gets himself in trouble, right? And all the fallout from that. And then, you know, the film he's making that year is actually a very serious and very, very contemplative film. The same guy has got, you know, both the good and the bad, if you will, percolating in the same head. So that's one reason why he's such a disturbing figure. You sometimes aren't quite sure what to make of him.
Yeah, that's a really good point. And I think part of it has to do with the fact that he enjoys, like you said, pushing people's buttons and pushing the envelope. And he clearly loves the spotlight. I wanted to mention his TV series, Danish TV series he did in 1994 called The Kingdom. Very bizarre, very weird. And at the end of each episode, he comes out, you know, kind of like Hitchcock did at the end of his programs, to sort of, you know, talk a little bit about what you just saw and set you up for the next episode. And it's, you know, you can't not listen to him. Well, even once you've watched something completely bizarre like The Kingdom, you know, when he comes on, somehow you still want to see what he's going to say, even though most of the time it's either self-congratulatory or bizarre.
That's a good point, because you're wondering just what to make of him. Is he on the level with some of these provocative statements? Is he joking? You know, is it a serious statement? I mean, he does that to get the audience engaged, or I would say agitated, and he's very good at getting us agitated. But again, a fundamental thing that has me always scratching my head and wondering about him is, we talked about how well he works with actors, the naturalistic performances, particularly with actresses, right? He really does great work there. And yet, what is he actually saying or doing with those characters? If you look at a number of his films, you've got to ask yourself, well, are these feminist statements, or, you know, prototypically feminist, or are they misogynistic, or some ambiguous mix of them? I mean, honestly, you're kind of like scratching your head. and you think, you know, is it misogynistic or is it feminist? You can watch a 2 or 3 hour long film by him and not be sure at the end, what is he saying about this female protagonist? There's a strong example of that in his film Antichrist from 2009. Charlotte Gainsbourg plays a mother who's grieving because her son has died. And when you watch that film, you're really not sure what his take is on her or on the material. And what you do come away with is, again, this overbearing sense of a director who is saying things thematically just to kind of like get the audience going, get us riled up. And one of my favorite negative reviews was where somebody described Antichrist as an erotic drama so pretentious it gives art films a bad name.
That's a great way of summing that up. And you know, I really like Charlotte Gainsbourg. She's one of my favorite actresses, and I cannot for the life of me figure out why she decided to do that movie.
Actors love to work with him. I mean, you know, when we talked about this earlier in our discussion today, the fact that, you know, he does work well with actors. Whatever you think of the characterization, whatever you think of the film thematically, whatever you feel about the director, you know, he really does work with them very well, as in the director and the actor going back and forth as a character is shaped. And I'm getting at it's in that very basic kind of primal way of an actor working with a director. And some of them have had bad experiences and don't want to work with them again. But others, including even people like Lauren Bacall, have worked with him in multiple movies. Charlotte Gainsbourg, that, you know, he actually does have actors who do like to return and work with him again.
I think there must be an element of masochism in there, because I do think some of his shots are just downright sadistic. I can see where you could make a case for some feminist thought in some of his movies. But for the most part, I think he really does seem to lovingly linger on shots of mutilation and just extreme gross out violence. But I think we can just leave that there. I don't know that we're recommending people see Antichrist. It's just important to mention it. But why don't we finish off by mentioning Nymphomaniac 1 and 2. What do you want to say about those movies, Mike?
Other than that I hate them.
Imagine, you know, how do you really feel, Mike?
I mean, you go by a movie theater, back when we had movie theaters, and you look up at the marquee and it says Nymphomaniac. Yes, it gets your attention. And again, that's Lars von Trier, determined to shock us, you know, to be provocative. And the films are, you know, we got to say it, they're explicit, but to what purpose? You know what I'm getting at? It just, he's doing these things just to get the audience riled up and agitated and so on. And yet there are the actors like Charlotte Gainsbourg who return in role after role. So I like when you said there's something almost masochistic about it, because, you know, these are not exactly feminist roles, though maybe they're claiming to be. There's something misogynistic and kind of like lingering, if you will, as to how the director kind of revels in this. I mean, what's the takeaway from this?
You have to wonder, because it's a provocative title. You can imagine he saw a script with that title and thought, oh, we're definitely doing this. But why do two? It's not like there were so many unanswered questions.
This is one of the main weaknesses of his career. A lot of his films are longer in running time than they really need to be. You know, if 2 hours would be enough, he's going to be 2.5 or 3 hours. Or in this case, with the film we're talking about right now, to make it and then do a sequel to it, like, as if the audience is looking for more.
I don't know how many people came to that second movie. But that brings us to the end of our segment on Lars von Trier. Don't forget to check out our other podcasts on dragondigitalradio.podbean.com. And we will see you at the movies.
See you then.
Connect with us. We are Dragon Digital Radio.